morning, everybody. Senate, and welcome to Senate Finance. It's February 20th, a couple minutes after 9. With me today, co-chair Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Schauer, Senator Malachowski. We've been joined by Senate President Giesel, Senator Costello, Stevens, Senator Hughes, and we might be joined by other senators as we go into the meeting today. Today we're going to continue our brief within measured in days, overview from OMB on the proposed operating budget. Again, it's a proposed budget from the governor. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, we'll start with them. We'll do judiciary, and then we'll go into the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And within that group, it includes the marine highways and airports. But before we get going, I'd like to remind the folks in the audience to please turn off their cell phones. It's distracting, and we've done really good the last couple weeks with it, not having interruptions with cell phones, so that's appreciated. We're also going to ask the committee members to try to tighten up the decorum and the focus of the questions a little bit, because we're running a little bit behind schedule in days. We'll try to slow down on pontificating and try to avoid the questions of if the presenter at the end of the table is going to quit beating their spouse or not in the budget, and try to reword those questions to more of a financial question. Well, I think it's well understood that the budget is work is being done in the direction of the governor through the Office of Management and Budget, and the commissioners are catching up on the budgetary impacts within their department. So we'll give them another opportunity, the ones that aren't here and even some of the ones that have already showed up, a return appearance at Senate Finance several weeks in advance after the subcommittees has done a lot of work, to go into even more detail. And in the meantime, between now and then, we will have the economist working for the governor. He'll be before the committee when he's ready. And it might be a couple weeks. I don't want too long of a delay, but I want him to be prepared, because I think the committee is going to have a litany of questions for multiple departments. So I spoke with him briefly late yesterday, and he's going to be working on that, and I'll work with my co-chair on the schedule, and we'll have Mr. King in front of us. But I want him ready, because we have an experienced committee here, and they have a few questions. But let's try to stay focused as the Finance Committee on finance questions, and treat our guests here to testify with respect, warrant their office and position, along with the public as they come forward here eventually also. We'll have to, and I'll be reminding the committee from time to time, because I think our patience will probably wear thin over the next few months, and some of these decisions have significant impacts to not only our district but our state, and some of them are a complete policy change of directions since state or since territorial days. So we will continue with our presentations. I'd like to have the OMB director come forward, and I have her talk about Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Donna Ardwin, OMB Director. At the table with me is our Budget Director, Saunders. She's going to speak about the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I believe on the phone we have Administrative Services Director for Military and Veterans Affairs, Keith Silver. But Director Saunders is going to take you through the presentation.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Budget Director for the Office of Management and Budget. The slides before you reflect the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs budget. The total budget for the FY19 management plan was $58,126,500. The total budget for FY20, Governor amended, is $58,674,100, an increase overall of $547,000. The unrestricted general funds are reduced by $940,100, from $16,969.9 million to $16,029,800. And I'll walk through the changes shortly on the next slide. Designated general funds did not change. They equaled $28,400 for both years. Other funds increased by $1,136,300,000 from $10,185.3 to $11,321.6. And federal funds increased from $30,942,900 to $31,294,300. The positions on the right-hand side reflect a change of permanent full-time positions going from 277 to 278, and permanent part-time and non-perm positions both decreased by 2. Oh, okay, thanks. Moving on to the next slide, this is a high-level summary of the changes to the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs budget. There was an increase of $50,000 in $50,000 general fund dollars for additional funding to support the funeral honor of Alaska veterans. There are 2 decrements deleting funding related to non-statutory or voluntary programs. $300,000 of general funds was reduced from the Local Emergency Planning Committee, as well as the Alaska State Defense Force, which was a program that was added last session, of $210,900. The budget includes the deletion of a vacant special assistant to the commissioner position, and as well the executive travel reduction, which was applied to all agencies. However, the Homeland Security and Emergency Management was excluded from this reduction. Questions?
That completes the slide on this one here. So we will have questions from Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Local Emergency Planning Committee, as I read it, there are 2 state statutes that require us to have a Local Emergency Planning Committee, and then there's actually a federal statute which requires that funding for disasters go through a Local Emergency Planning Committee. So I'm just curious how we're going to get around that if we eliminate the LEPC.
The funding is subject to appropriation, and the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management can still continue to support the Local Emergency Planning Committees as they receive funding from other sources. I'm sorry, that was through the chair. I apologize.
And the on your slide dealing with the funding for the funeral honor support, is that for the Fairbanks cemetery that we took action on a few years ago, or can you give us a little highlight on that?
Chair Stedman, that is not in relation to the Fairbanks cemetery. That is just funding for the Department of Veteran Services to attend or to coordinate the travel and attendance at the Alaska veterans' funerals.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there any programs within the Military and Veterans Affairs budget that are non-statutory that are funded?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the only one that comes to mind at the moment is the Alaska Military Youth Academy.
And how much are we spending there?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't have a total in front of me. I can get back to you with that information.
Okay, if you can get back to the committee on that and maybe put it with a comparison of the previous couple years. So It'd be more meaningful.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, for the committee's sake and whoever's the chairman, weighing the, I know that the Academy does provide a lot of good things to the state, but we need to weigh those against commitments of statutory nature, such as the Local Emergency Planning Committee and the work that all of them have done. What where would we be if we did not have that fund when we had the November 30th earthquake? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I do actually have the total in front of me. I apologize for being delayed. The total budget for the Alaska Military Youth Academy for the FY20 proposed budget is $9.4 million. But we can provide additional historical information if the committee wishes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Senator Hoffman, you want a policy discussion at some time through this process on the prioritization of the spending in this department to make sure that we're taking care of the potential emergency needs if that happens to this or required by the state?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And I assume that the department, OMB, is going to submit the prioritized list from the departments in the subcommittee process still? And it should appear there?
To the chair, yes. Those are being provided by the agencies to the subcommittees. Okay.
Senator Schauer, I think you are point person on that. If you could follow up with Senator Hoffman on that issue, it would be appreciated. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. I just wanted to state for unrestricted general funds, fiscal year 19, Military Youth Academy was $4.6 million, and the proposed 2020 is $4.5 million for roughly $100,000 decrease. So I think in the subcommittees, please include the rationale of why it was decreased in terms of number of kids served, number of kids graduating, things of that nature.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I can speak to the $100,000 reduction. It was a fund source change from unrestricted general funds to statutory designated program receipts. The Alaska Military Youth Academy is going to be reaching out to other entities, nonprofits, tribal corporations, to see if there are donations that are available to fill that funding.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
One final point. Is the administration going to submit statutory requirements for the Youth Academy, or is that not one of them?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that is not one of the statutory changes that will be submitted.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
On that, excuse me, Mr. Chair. On that same line for the Alaska State Defense Force and the Local Emergency Planning Committee, is the department also looking to change that statutorily?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, no. There are no statutory changes related to either of these programs.
I'll follow up.
Roll up.
Then, you know, basically, the U.S. Constitution allows allows all the states to establish their own militia that can be called up for, so you don't have to use in terms of large fires, disasters, and other issues that may come to our state as it has come in the past. How are we looking to fund a defense force? Are you looking to fund our defense force through the emergency funding that the state has available, or just as an ongoing basis, or for training purposes, just looking to see how the upkeep of our Alaska State Defense Force may be looked at in terms of the administration?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs should speak to the answer to that. I do know that the State Active Defense Force is a component of the department, and when there are disasters, they are able to collect revenue to pay for those members to volunteer their time and be called into state active duty to respond to the disasters or emergencies.
We have any other questions on this one? Okay, I guess we're done with this. We'll go to the next item. Introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and present your slides, and we'll have some questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. And because the judicial branch submits its budget directly to the legislature, I'll be presenting on behalf of the court. I'm afraid I'm not sure how to advance the slides here. There we go. Thank you. I'll start at the top of our, on the left-hand slides. Aside the top two categories, as you can see, neither our federal receipt authority nor our other categories have changed this year. And our federal receipt authority, which is largely hollow, but we get about $380,000 in federal receipts. Most of that goes to support a what's called a court improvement project, which is a federally sponsored and funded program that tries to improve our child in need of aid cases, which are our child protection cases, and another $80,000 that goes to, in the federal grant that helps support a therapeutic court in Palmer. In the other category, the $2.2 million is made up of interagency receipts, which is $1.4 million unchanged, program receipts of $585,000 also unchanged. And then every year, as you know, Mr. Chairman, the Mental Health Trust Authority helps sponsor our therapeutic court costs, but every year that money comes out of the budget and then comes back in. That also is unchanged from last year. The big category, of course, we are primarily general fund, funded with general funds, and included in the $109.4 million in general funds is $518,000 in designated general funds, and that is funds that we get through the alcohol tax, and that goes to treatment in some of our therapeutic courts. Our amended budget, which I'll talk about probably mostly on the left-hand side, but there are two, the next slide, there are two main increments that we've asked for this year. The first deals with increased lease costs in several of our court facilities, and the other is funds to reopen on Friday afternoons, which I'll talk about in a minute. The first increment is just shy of $400,000 for increased lease costs. Our lease for the court facility in Bethel, we had been in a 20-year lease. That lease recently expired. We renegotiated the lease, and over the last 20 years, our lease payments had fallen below market rates. When we renegotiated that lease, it increased our lease cost by $164,000. And the other big chunk of this lease increase is for the Diamond Courthouse across the street here in Juneau. That's part of the Public Building Fund. It's managed by Department of Administration. Every year they assess our proportion of the cost of that building, and their assessment this year went up $116,000. So $393,000 in increased lease cost, and that's the first increment. The second increment, and the one that has probably generated the most interest, is $3.1 million to reopen courts on Friday afternoons. As you may recall, Mr. Chairman, in fiscal year 2017, the court system opted to close courts on Friday afternoons as a way to save about $2 million in personnel costs. Our employees work Monday through Thursday, 8 to 5, and then on Fridays from 8 to noon. That's a 4% reduction in the time they work, and came with a 4% reduction in pay. We didn't initially ask for the funds to reopen on Friday afternoons for a couple of reasons. One, the court realizes that the state remains in a difficult fiscal environment. And the other reason was, although it has created some inconveniences, closures on Friday afternoon has not proven to be a significant bottleneck in the justice system. And there are some benefits with it as well. By closing on Friday afternoons, judges have bench time or time in their office
to resolve all the things they need to resolve when they're not sitting in court, all resolving motions, writing opinions. It also creates a time every week where all of the other normal, regular participants in the court system know they won't have hearings. So Office of Children's Services, the lawyers, civil and criminal lawyers, all know they have Friday afternoons without hearings. So that does create some benefits. Nevertheless, we only closed on Friday afternoons in order to save money. And if we hadn't been looking to save money, we wouldn't have closed. And there are some problems associated with closing on Friday afternoons, the biggest of which is a loss of hearing time. One afternoon a week is the equivalent of 26 days a year of lost hearing times, and that ends up slowing things down and putting things off. Hearings that could have been held have to be set off later and later. There are some administrative problems as well with closing on Friday afternoons. We don't get mail delivered or picked up twice a day, which can end up meaning things that would have gone out on a Friday go out on a Monday. We're slower in making payments to vendors. We're slower in making payments to reimbursing court employees for travel costs. We're slower at doing distributing records. There are problems with closing on Friday afternoons, and we do support this increase. After hearing the state address by the governor, we heard him express his interest that the court opens on Friday afternoons. So we met with the Office of Management and Budget to see about how we would go about doing that. They said they would support a request for the extra funding to do that. So we amended our budget request to include the cost, which is a total of $3.1 million, which includes on the other slide there, there's the slide I'm talking about. But on this slide, you can see the employee count goes up. We've got 15 more employees that go along with it. When we closed on Friday afternoons, at the same time, we reduced our employees by 15. This brings us back up so that we can adequately staff the extra hearing time. But that's what our budget looks like this year. The big story is the reopening on Friday afternoons.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this budget reflect the two Superior Court judges to replace the two District Court judges and Homer and Valdez proposed in Senate Bill 41?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, no. That's part of it. That's in a fiscal note attached to that bill.
Thank you.
Senator from Bethel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my fellow Alaskans. The budget, you said, was reduced by $2 million for Friday afternoons, but here you're asking for $3.1 million. So can you explain what additionally is being requested here above and beyond the $2 million that you had reduced?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, yes, there are two parts of it. The $2 million reflects the cut, the 4% pay reduction for our employees to go from 37 and a half hours a week to 36 hours a week. The rest of it is bringing back in the 15 employees that we also lost at the same time we moved to Friday afternoon closures. So between bringing those employees back and the $2 million equals $3.1 million.
And the final question, Mr. Chairman, is regarding the Bethel court. If you do not get the $165,000 increase for the facility after 20 years, what are the plans of the judiciary?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, in our renegotiated lease with the City of Bethel, we have a provision that would allow us to reduce the size of our court facility in Bethel to make up a good chunk of that. But the difference we would just have to absorb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So I understand the rationale to reopen courts. You make a good case for that, and I see that with loss of about 26 days, I think you mentioned, so it makes sense. But I also I have to suspect that during the last year or so, when the courts were not open on Fridays, you were still utilizing your time well by doing research or catching up on paperwork, analyzing cases, organizing the schedule, meeting with clients, whatever the activities are. With this reopen of courts, how will you make up for that lost time that you've been utilizing for the last year on that Friday afternoons, doing important work as well?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, it is a trade-off. When we started closing on Friday afternoons, there were some benefits we didn't anticipate, and some of them were judges. Judges, they're like legislators too. They're on committees. They meet now. They meet on Friday afternoons. That's a benefit. But the biggest impact, really, is still the loss of hearings. And judges continued to work. Judges didn't go to 36 hours a week. Judges still work long hours, including on weekends. And by reopening on Fridays, the public benefits, we have longer lines now on Friday mornings. The public expects us to be open, but there will be a loss of some of the benefits that we've had. Judges will be deciding motions on longer weekends and things, but there is a cost to the system. There's some efficiencies with closing on Friday afternoons, but it does slow down cases, and reopening will move things along more quickly.
General Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. If you could talk about, do the employees like the Friday afternoons off, number one, how's that affected employee morale? And number two is, just if you could address there still are emergency hearings that are done. There still are quite a few hearings. And my understanding is this will have a minimal impact on public safety hearings, because emergency hearings are already being done. So if you could address those two issues.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we've never polled our employees on whether they like Friday afternoon closures, but anecdotal evidence is people do generally like the Friday afternoons off. But they also took a 4% pay cut, and getting a full paycheck is also important to those same employees. And you're right that there are lots of things we continue to do Friday afternoons. There are still emergency hearings and child need of aid cases. Criminal arraignments are still done in Anchorage and Fairbanks on Friday afternoons. Trials can continue on Friday afternoons now in Fairbanks and Bethel and other cases in other locations upon request. Search warrants are still issued. And arrest warrants are still issued. So you're right. There are a lot of things that still happen on Friday afternoons. It's not like Friday afternoon comes and all court work stops. Things do continue on. And the impact on the criminal justice system, we have tried to mitigate through those steps, like the arraignments and the trials and things. One of the reasons, as I mentioned, we didn't ask for it is we don't think we have been a big bottleneck. But the public expects us to be open. It has been inconvenient. This past year, we saw our highest level of felony filings in our state's history. Those cases are going to be coming to trial in FY20. We're going to need hearing time on Friday afternoons to better address those. So there is an impact. But you're right, Senator. We have worked hard to have a minimal impact on the criminal justice system.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there are four crime bills that are going through right now, may or may not pass in the form they are in. But I would anticipate if they do, that your workload is probably going to require that Friday afternoon, just a guess, based on what I'm hearing so far. Have you looked at or analyzed what may happen to your workload based on how these crime bills are structured at all? So I'm just curious if that's something you've looked in the future.
And before you answer that, in previous hearings, Senator Schauer, unfortunately, missed them. There was some concern that the system or the budgets presented were of sufficient nature to deal with the tightening of the statutes and the crime package. So the concern that is being expressed is We want to have assurances from the court that you're prepared to handle the increased customer load that we anticipate you're going to be getting.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Schauer, there will likely be a fiscal impact from those bills, and Nancy Mead, our general counsel, who's back here, is will be submitting fiscal notes associated with those bills. So additional workload associated with the passage of that legislation will be attached to the fiscal notes, attached to the bills as fiscal notes. But the Friday afternoon reopening is a piece of that. We do anticipate more criminal proceedings, and we would like to be open Friday afternoons to better address them.
Okay. Senator Machicki, you wanted to ask about general funds?
This is a question for you, Mr. Chairman. At some point, can we get how the decisions were made on what required legislation was included in the budget for making some of the changes and which weren't? Because we're hearing a mix, and that's fine. I'd just like to understand how those decisions were made from OMB. Pretty important.
When he's done, we'll have OMB come up and you can ask him the question directly. Do you have any other questions for representative from the courts? He's assured us that he's going to be able to take care of the workload coming, and we intend to increase it. Okay, if we can have a representative from OMB, either the director or her designee.
Mr. Chairman, I would just add that the court system didn't build its budget around legislation that had yet to be introduced. So any increased cost will come through fiscal notes for us.
Right, correct. And we'll be asking you as we go down the line, court system, and keeping tabs on that so we end up with a balanced package from the state troopers and village public safety officers all the way to the jailhouse. We want to make sure there's no gaps so we can deal with this issue that the public has been, frankly, outraged about. Senator Machicki, you want to restate your question for the OMB director, please?
Yeah, please. Two examples. The crime packages are not included in this budget and are likely a substantial increase. But other issues are like the oil and gas property tax that requires legislation. So just how were those decisions made, and can you provide us with sort of an expected add going forward if the key bills that are priorities to the governor are passed?
Through the chair, Senator, I'm sorry, are you talking about the governor's anti-crime bills?
Yes.
So the governor has submitted, through the chair, the governor has submitted a package of legislation dealing with our crime problem. Those pieces of legislation have fiscal notes on them, which we've included in the fiscal summary as part of this budget.
Okay. So they're included as part of the budget, is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. We will pull those out, Senator Machicki, and basically list them out in the fiscal impacts to help all the committee members track them, because we're going to have a lot of bills moving around. And I see your bewilderment on the answer. So we'll get that, Senator Machicki, so we'll get that straightened out for you.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff. We don't know, maybe the OMB director is prepared to help us with, but how many more pieces of legislation should the Finance Committee be thinking about that may be coming to put this package together that fits in with the budget requests before
us? I'm going to ask for help from my staff.
We'll have a brief at ease. We're going to come back on the record and end the chaos. Legislative Finance is also working on this list, the package of actually, because there is a little bit of confusion, what's included, what's coming in physical notes. So we'll get that straightened out, and that presentation, hopefully will be ready in their presentation on Monday or Tuesday, but we'll have that for the committee so it's very clear what's in the budget in front of you, what's in the different pieces of legislation that are laying out there, not only the crime package impacts, but other legislation that will impact the budget, so it's real clear because there's just so many moving parts. But if you could maybe help with that question and then we'll move on. That was asked, it caused so much confusion.
So through the chair, the Department of Law is still working on a number of our bills, and so they consolidate them after we've submitted them. So I believe the number will be approximately 16, of which I believe four have been introduced. Okay. Those bills, which have fiscal notes on them, are not included in the appropriations bill that we submitted, or the three appropriations bill that we submitted, because they have fiscal notes. Those fiscal notes are included in the fiscal summary that we gave you, so we consider them part of the budget.
Right, okay. Thank you for that clarification. We have other questions on judiciary. Okay, well, thank you very much. Next up, I guess, is Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Mr. Chairman, I've been joined by Amanda Holland, the Management Director for the Department of Office of Management and Budget. She was recently the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Amanda Holland. I am Management Director in the Office of Management and Budget. Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to present the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities FY 2020 Governor's Amended Budget to you. This first slide shows you the summary of the FY 2020 proposed budget. The total budget for the operating budget for fiscal year 19 management plan was $593,349,600. The total proposed budget with the governor's amended budget for fiscal year 2020 is $533,126,500. For a difference of $60,223,000. The general fund difference between the two budgets is $96,050,300. A breakout,
Go ahead and continue.
A breakout of the general fund amounts. So for the 19 management plan, UGF, or unrestricted general fund amount, was $179,988,800. And the designated general fund amount for 19 was $98,821,000. In fiscal year 2020 proposed, the unrestricted general fund amount is $122,788,000. The designated general fund amount is $59,971,500. So the difference in UGF between 19 and 20 is $57,200,800. The difference in designated general fund is $38,849,500. The green column, part of the column, represents other funding for the department. In 19, other funding totaled $312,404,700. In the 20 proposed, it totals $348,757,000. That is an increase of $36,352.3. The majority of that increase is for interagency receipts for the newly established Division of Facility Services inside the department. For our federal funding in 19, the total was $2,135,100. And in 20, it is $1,610,000 for a difference of $525,100. On budgeted positions, we have 4 full-time permanent positions and 3 permanent part-time positions removed from the budget, and we show an increase of 5 non-permanent positions. I would like to point out that most of this position movement reflects positions that are moving in and out of the department. Primarily, there are Department of Transportation and Public Facility positions that are moving to the Department of Administration, to the Office of Information Technology, as part of that consolidation. And there are some positions moving into the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities from other agencies as part of the Facility Services consolidation.
That concludes this slide. Before you go to the next slide, I'm confused. So help me, because we've got the Marine Highway, we've got roads and bridges and maintenance, you know, and then we've got rural and urban airports. So how come the commission or the position count is staying the same when we have the budgetary implications of terminating the existence of the Marine Highway on October 1 and terminating the employees?
Chair Stedman, at this time, the budget proposes that the Marine Highway system will continue to operate, and the summer sailing schedule does require our vessels to be fully staffed, and so there will be Marine Highway positions throughout fiscal year 2020. The plan for the entire run of fiscal year 2020 is being worked on. The governor issued a directive last week, and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and the governor's office will be working together with an economic and marine consultant to identify options for how to reshape the Alaska Marine Highway system. And so at this time, the budget reflects the positions necessary for us to continue our sailing schedule as is currently scheduled.
The current schedule, my understanding, is to terminate the scheduling October 1 or September 1. Can you clarify the date?
Chair Stedman, at this time, the schedule looks at operating through the summer, and then for the month of September, there would be reduced service, and then there would be potentially no service starting in October. However, the Alaska Marine Highway System is continuing to look at options for how they might readjust that sailing schedule.
So should the committee then expect an amendment coming forward to keep the sailing of the Marine Highway from October through the end of June?
Chair Stedman, I don't have an exact answer for you at this time. I would not rule out a possibility.
Okay. There's roughly 318 shoreside and ships employees. The termination of them as of the 1st of October. How do you rectify your position count with the termination of the employees? I mean, that's what's on the budget in front of us today. I'm still puzzled with that. Your position count is not maybe accurate for the month of June, but it seems to be totally distorted for the month of December.
Chair Stedman, the Marine Highway System, particularly the vessel employees, operate on a regularly scheduled reduction in force. And so in October, many of the vessels go into layup or overhaul, and employees do experience a reduction in force. We do not at this time have the exact makeup of the reduction in force for October.
And when should we expect the reduction in force numbers to be presented to the committee for consideration in the budgetary process?
The department and the governor's office will have a report to the governor for the Marine Highway Plan. It is due August 1st of 2019 for all of the options going forward for the Marine Highway System. The budget that is put before you ensures budget of all of the Marine Highway positions for the next 3 to 6 months. And it is our anticipation that through that plan we will have clear direction in terms of where those positions will be going, or whether it'll be a reduction in force, or whether in fact it would be an elimination of positions.
And I'll get with you, Senator Wilkowski. I've got a litany of questions here, and normally I let the committee go first, but I don't see too many committee members that are impacted as much as the chairman and his region and the coastal region. So I've got a series of just off the top of my head questions that be fired down the table. So might as well relax and get comfortable in your chair. Back in when we became a state many, many years ago, when I was a little boy, one of the first things the state did at the end of statehood and the end of territorial days and the beginning of statehood is work on transportation. One of the first statewide bond initiatives when we became a state was the implementation of a marine highway system for coastal Alaska. That was voted on in a statewide, the marine highway was then built and launched with some ships that are still running today and some shoreside services. So termination of the marine highway is one of these policies that go back, frankly, into the territorial days and almost 60 years thereafter. In doing that, transportation system, because we have not had any roads constructed in my adult lifetime to open up new areas from DOT, and we'll get into that with DOT. So this has been the main transportation corridor in coastal Alaska. So we also wanted to have, from a statewide policy perspective, development of shoreside infrastructure improvements, shipyards, boat repair. The area in southeast have been building ships since the Russians were here. They logged the sides of the mountains in Sitka and built a fleet of ships. And we've had shipbuilding in Alaska since then. The Corps the state has a shipyard, and the location happened to be selected in Ketchikan after their statewide review. And I don't know, and we'll get the numbers from ADA, Alaska Industrial Development Authority. They're the owners of the shipyard, we, the people. And we built that shipyard, and we have about $100 million is what I'd expect, somewhere in there, of sunk cost. And we've been struggling to get that shipyard profitable so it could pay a dividend to the state and we could have it at this table. They employ roughly 120 to 130 employees. Their main cornerstone of service is the Marine Highway. So we own the ships. We own the people, own the shipyard. Has there been dialogue with the shipyard on the elimination of the ships to the shipyard? And has there been any response back from the shipyard on the shutdown and termination of that? And it's roughly 120 to 130 base employees, and it goes up sometimes to over 200. So what impact and conversations have taken place on this budget proposal in front of us dealing with the shipyard and the policy directional change of that?
Chair Stedman, I have had conversations with the department. I am not aware of what conversations the department has had with the shipyard or with ADA. Okay. I would defer to them.
We will defer that question to the shipyard, or the shipyard question to the commissioner. We've also just finished construction, or near finishing, they haven't had delivery, two new ships. We have had, and they're mostly general funds. We have substantial funds that come in every year from the federal highways to maintain and operate the ships and build and maintain shoreside. So when we shut this down on October 1st, what is the budgetary impact on return request of federal funds to the feds for ceasing the operation of this, of these ships? And you can include the shipyard also, if there's any funds available there or wrapped into that, if you know of any.
Chair Stedman, I am not aware of costs incurred through the shipyard. What I do know is that if vessels are not operating, when they go into layup, we have vessels in layup almost every winter. And when those vessels are in layup, there are still crew who staff them to ensure that they're maintained through the winter. As long as the vessels are in the possession of the state of Alaska, it is my understanding that there is no federal payback required at that time. The intricacies of the Federal Highway Administration payback process is not one of my areas of expertise. I could certainly get back to the committee with information.
Yes, we'll have that request into the department, and they can, you can assist the department, however that combination comes back. We had built two marine highway terminals, one in Kaufman Cove and one in South Petersburg on the Gulf Highway. Built those for, I don't know, 15, 20 million a pop, something like that. I have to go look. And that run, and we called it the North End, was not financially successful, and it was terminated, leaving us with the infrastructure in place of the shoreside. The federal government wanted their money back, and for those listening at home, we don't really like write them a check. They deduct it out of federal highways, which could be Senator Bishop's area or Senator Michikee or somewhere other than Southeast, because we don't have much for highway action coming. That request was on the table, and we were very concerned here at Finance for several years as we tried to get a workaround. And they started doing some, consultation with federal highways, some stops from time to time in those facilities, so we did not have to return those funds. So I'd like to have the administration get back to the committee on the federal fiscal impact of termination of the Marine Highway, because that is, in fact, what's in the middle of the table, from what I can see. Unless there's a plan for a special session in the fall to implement an operational budget from October 1st to June 1st or June 30th. And that may be the plan. I'm not aware of one. Issue, one of your line item issues that I see here in the budget is to remove the fuel component from 20,600,000 rounded off to 4 million. So that alone will terminate the existence of the Marine Highway. Senator Wilikowski, you want to ask a question so the blood pressure of the chairman goes down, and I might have a few more before I let him off the hot seat.
Yeah, I have a couple questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
My district is impacted by Marine Highway System. I represent Jay Bear. Many military members transfer to and from Alaska via the Marine Highway. Now, I'm just curious, are you still selling tickets after October 1st or issuing refunds after that time?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I have not checked with the department to see how they're advertising a schedule beyond September. I can get back to the committee with what their current schedule, published schedule, entails, what months.
Okay.
Go ahead and follow. So,
thank you. And then I'm just curious how you've gone about enlistment of a qualified Marine consultant. Is there an appropriation in the budget for that? What is the scope of work, and what is the directive from the administration? And how will you pay going forward, depending on the consultant's findings, if there's nothing budgeted in the budget for that consultant?
When you answer Senator Wilkowski's question, if you can maybe broaden it and help, that was another question I was going to ask about. We've had, I don't know how much money we've spent the state on studies on the Marine Highway. It seems like every governor has a different plan, and that's one of the management issues. Sometimes every governor has several directors. It's very, very difficult. It seems like we've got a whole library full of studies on the Marine Highway. So could you help us why we'd require a new one versus using this, the stuff we've already done to try to come up with a way of fixing the monetary demands that the Marine Highway faces on the table every year that we've been struggling with and trying to, frankly, minimize as much as we can?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I will do my best to address your questions. I may need to defer some of it. There have been numerous studies that have been conducted regarding the Marine Highway system. Often those studies addressed specific topics. For example, there was a study done by the McDowell Group in 2016 that looked at one aspect of the Marine Highway system's operations. There has been a reform white paper that was written, and I apologize, I don't know the exact date of it. I think it was in 2017 that was crafted with the help of Southeast Conference. Many of these, or the two papers that I've mentioned, addressed, as I said, certain aspects of the Marine Highway system, but not necessarily looking at the Marine Highway system as a whole to say, what are the transportation modes available in Southeast Alaska today, and what are all of the options available for operation of the Alaska Marine Highway System? My understanding in terms of the Qualified Economic Marine Consultant is that the department and the governor's office will be working together to identify the competencies that are necessary in that consultant, and that what that consultant will be assisting the state in doing is looking at all of the options that are available, what is possible to reshape the Alaska Marine Highway system so that it is a more sustainable and affordable system. And that could range from a public-private partnership type of relationship, which could address some of the federal funding issues, to looking at a different type of marine highway system, a different look and feel.
Follow up, and then we're going to go to Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Schauer.
Yeah, and...
And then, excuse me, Senator Bishop before Schauer. He was first. Go ahead.
And I'm just trying to... I didn't see in the change record detail any funding for this qualified marine consultant, and I'm just curious if I'm missing that. And could I get a copy of any RFP, or could the committee get a copy of any RFP or directive? That's, I know that governor's issued an administrative order, but I guess I'm interested in seeing the request for a proposal, the RFP. Is that something that's public?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, an RFP has not yet been issued, and RFPs, our requests for proposals, are public. And so as soon as that is developed, I would be happy to share that with the committee.
Okay, well, Senator Von Imhoff, then Senator Bishop, and then we'll go to Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So we're talking about these studies that have been done in recent years, and you touched upon it, saying that they weren't exactly for the whole system. They were bits and pieces of it. So I have basically two parts to this question, Chair Stedman. Did you use any portions of these studies to help guide your decision to reduce the Alaska Marine Highway? And if you didn't use these studies, what did you use?
Good help, Senator Von Imhoff, with the background of the decision.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, certainly the experts on the Marine Highway system that work in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities were consulted when we looked at possible budget changes for the FY 2020 budget, and they are much more familiar with the results of those studies than I personally am. We did work with them, with the department, to discuss what the impacts would be if we were to move forward with this budget proposal.
Quick follow-up.
Unfortunately, the department heads are not here today, so we will have to wait to get those answered. So the question that I have then, in line of some of the other senators speaking, is why the rush? Why are we just cutting several tens of millions of dollars in 1 year, a short period of time, versus over a course of a couple years, particularly to allow this consultant to finish his or her work? Why are we just game over as of the end of October?
Through the chair, Senator Von Inhofe, when we looked at the fiscal situation facing the state today, we talked to the department about its priority programs, about its core services, and where its funding, how its funding is split out. And in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, over 90% of the unrestricted general fund in the department resides in either the Alaska Marine Highway System or the Highways, Aviation, and Facilities Results Delivery Unit. And in working toward a sustainable, affordable budget, the Alaska Marine Highway System was identified as a system that was less efficient and effective in using its unrestricted general fund. For example, if you look at the Marine Highway System, in 1992, the farebox recovery rate for the Marine Highway System was a little over 60%. So the farebox recovery rate is how much money, if you will, the system was able to bring in to cover its costs versus how much money it relied on receiving from the state of Alaska. In 2018, the farebox recovery rate was 33.3%. And so, and if we look historically, we can see that the farebox recovery rate for the Marine Highway System has gone down in past years. It's a pretty steady trend. At the same time, if we look at ridership for the ferry system, in the early 90s, it hit its peak for passengers, which was just over 450,000 passengers. In 2016, it averaged a little over 250,000 passengers. And if we look at the trend line, we can see that passenger ridership is consistently going down on the ferry system. Vehicle ridership has stayed steady since 1988. That's the earliest tracking method that I've seen is from 1988. The vehicle ridership has stayed at roughly 100,000 the entire time. So when we look at revenue potential and the possibilities of the system to be able to increase its farebox recovery rate, one of the things we have to start looking at is, can we afford to keep the Alaska Marine Highway System in its current state with large vessels serving 35 communities year-round?
A couple of points. I think just off my top of my head, because I don't have the Marine Highway data presentations in front of me, they roughly gross around $50 million a year, mid-40s, sometimes they creep over a little bit 50. And I think we've had the GF appropriation here at the table considerably more than that. And I think currently it's somewhere around in the low 70s or some number. I haven't been at this table for a few years, but it was higher than that several years before as we were working on increasing the efficiencies of the propulsion units, including propellers and engines and driving other efficiencies into the system while we were fighting the escalating cost of older ships and trying to accelerate the construction of new ships to get our labor costs and our operation costs down, two of which ships are tied to the dock, almost completed and ready for delivery. Now we're faced with a budgetary proposal for elimination. That is what this budget does. It's an elimination budget, in my opinion, of the Marine Highway. That is a whole different discussion than bringing the GF appropriation amount down to equal a fare box. And I think if you go back further than the dates used here earlier on historical numbers, the target historically has always been a dollar for dollar to the fare box, which would put the GF appropriation somewhere in the mid-40s. You can operate a skeleton relative to, let me change that word. You can run a reduced schedule, keeping the operational integrity of the facility intact, keeping the maintenance of the project of the vessels and the certifications intact, while you go through the analytical process of trying to decide the policy move to either divest the Marine Highway and its terminals, which is a direct a quote out of the budget documents, from what I could see. That would allow us then to operate this facility while we get it restructured. It's very difficult to kick everybody out of an apartment house, let it sit vacant, and then turn around and try to sell your apartment house, to put it in another context. Also, we haven't mentioned, and I'd like to mention, just we've had delivery or a transportation struggle with Prince of Wales Island. And the state has been helping subsidize the private operator, which is some of the communities went together. They bought two ships, and they run a ferry route from Ketchikan to Hollis on Prince Wales Island. And we've been subsidizing them $250,000 a year the last few years to keep them afloat and operational. And previous to that, it was $500,000 when we had to step in and bail them out to keep that facility going. So in the discussion here, I'd like to see what the budgetary position is on dealing with the what is referred to as the Inner Island Ferry. And that would be a easy example to look at what a privatization model looks like, still needing subsidies. So has OMB looked at that? And let me just, for the public, let me just say, several years ago when Senator Hoffman and myself were sitting at the table struggling with some of these issues, he was the operating budget chairman. And one of the solutions we came up with is the delivery, the request and the delivery of the financial documents to the OMB department, which I think OMB still gets on a timely matter. So the OMB director can monitor the fiscal position of that entity and then factor that into the consideration of any recommendation she makes, was a gal at the time, she makes to the governor for consideration at the table. And that seemed to have worked very well the last several years. So does OMB have any comment you want to make on the Inner Island Ferry? And then I'll go to the, I think it's Senator Bishop up next.
Chair Stedman, I know that the department has factored in the Inland Ferry Authority with its analysis of all options regarding reshaping the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Okay, that's a nice, okay. If the state, it's my belief, if the state had not stepped in with $500,000 a year for several years and reduced it to 200, I think it's 250 now, that transportation system would not exist today. That's how tight they run. Senator Bishop, you're the man from Fairbanks.
Thank you. I'm going to stay right on point because I've got a lot of questions, and Amanda will do that in the subcommittee. Just one quick question. Senator Stedman's doing a good job of covering all my talking points, but have we anticipated how much refunds that are going to be required because of bookings? You know how the bookings are made on our Bellingham run here a year in advance, right? That's one of the advantages by putting out a ferry schedule, as we've talked about in DOT in the past. When we publish that schedule and it's published a year ahead of time, the traveling public, you know, make those reservations because they're hard to get. So Have we started thinking about notifying people that possibility we might not have a ferry run next year?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I know that the department has factored in its published sailing schedule and the reservations it already has received into its plan for how it would operate under the proposed 2020 budget amounts. So they have been looking at what's already been sold, what's already been published, and what are public expectations regarding ridership.
So the just to help add to that some numerics, and then I'll let you get to your follow-up question, just real quick for the public. Reservation and marketing for FY19 was, I'll round it off, $2 million. Nice, it was $2 billion, but $2,052,000, rounded off, for this is reservations and marketing. Current budget in front of the committee is for $631,600. That alone would, when you link it into the fuel adjustment, going from 20.5 to $4 million, tells me there is termination of the Marine Highway on October 1st. So what is the plan and the thought, and how are you going to rejuvenate this reservation system or get your customers to get the system back up and running if you shut it down? And then Senator from Fairbanks might have a question on RV traffic to Fairbanks, but go ahead.
Chair Stedman, my understanding is that the department has converted to an online reservation system, and that they have been gradually increasing the amount of online reservation passengers so that more and more people are using an online system, which does not require as many staff, and so that does allow some reduction in the budget. The Marine Highway system is continuing to look at all options. When they look at running and what sailings they may take, it's entirely possible that sailings may be less frequent but continue, and so that's one of the things that they are looking at. That's part of what this consultant will help them review, is what is the maximum service they can provide with the budget that they are appropriated that allows them the greatest return in revenue. So they are looking at how do we optimize what we have, how do we best use the resources that are allocated to us.
I still have a concept problem. Looking at the budget submission, it looks like a termination and liquidation. If the analytics that are going to be run show that, you know, we're better off to run at a reduced service and maybe privatize some of the outlying smaller villages and feeder system or, you know, some slight modification, how do we get the system up and running when the legislature doesn't reconvene till January and it's October 1st? I have trouble getting to that point. So if you guys can help, or with the, I'm sure we'll have a, I see the commissioner of DOT is not online. I'm sure we'll have a lot of questions for him. We'll most likely be holding the subcommittee on this subject matter at this table, live on camera. So help me with that concept of how do we get the document put together, August 1st deadline, get it implemented, and get us to the next fiscal year so we can have a skeleton system without a special session for an appropriation, because nobody wants to have big supplemental budgets, and clearly that would be a tough one to have something of this magnitude in a supplemental.
Chair Stedman, if I may, I would defer to when the department is able to address that situation. They have a much more in-depth knowledge of figuring out sailing schedules, the cost of every vessel, how many passengers and vehicles they have on each vessel, and what their different options would be for operation.
We'll take that. Don't get excited because you heard the bells. We're going to be here a few more minutes, and then we'll let you go. Senator Bishop from Fairbanks, and Willikowski, did you have a question? And then Shower.
Briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, you know, not all of our constituents, for the most part, they're watching right now because it's on TV. And I just want to get this comment in because they don't get to see the subcommittee as well as this committee. But to dovetail on Senator Wilikowski's earlier comment, the interior of Alaska does rely on the Alaska Marine Highway System, believe it or not. We have four military posts and bases, and they utilize it. With that being said, as a kid that grew up in Southeast, I just want to reiterate again that the Alaska Marine Highway System is important, and I want to help try to find the best resolution going forward. Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looked online on my phone, and it on the Marine Highway System, it shows no runs after September 30th. I don't know if that's normally how they do it or not, but my question is that the governor was in Ketchikan 11 days before the election and said categorically he did not support cutting the Marine Highway. And I'm just wondering what's changed since that time in the last 3 months.
Right, let's relay that. That's probably a question for the governor himself rather than I understand the document you're referring to, which was an editorial in the Ketchikan paper with several quotes. But thank you for the question, but it's best delivered or on a mission from their boss, so we'll have that conversation possibly with the governor himself. Would be better for him to speak for himself. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an email. We've been talking to DOT, and they say in this email specifically that they are planning zero ferry transport from October to June. So DOT's plan actually has no ferry plan in it at all, just FYI.
What's the date of the email?
This morning. So okay, well, it's just FYI.
They're following the budget presentation or the budget proposal. You can't fault them for that. That's your job.
Just putting it out there because you're okay. It's a question, but their plan is not to use it. It is. I do. There's context here, so it's going to take a second. The last, before I retired from the military, last exercise that it was a FEMA exercise, big earthquake. And, you know, I've got two ports as well and multiple military bases. But that exercise, one of the points was to show that without the ports, we die. Because almost all of our goods comes through those ports that we need for everything that we basically survive on. You cannot survive with just the aircraft, airports. You can't do it. So you can't possibly bring enough aircraft in. And a stat that was sticks to my mind, an airlift effort three times the size of the Berlin airlift effort in Germany back in the 1950 time frame, it would take three times the size of that effort just to keep Anchorage alive with an airport if it's available. So it's not physically possible to be done. The reason I bring that up is because in the statement here it says rural airport evaluation, it looks like it has been cut. And lots of going on here as far as the ports and what's important in the ferry system schedule. But one of the things that seems crystal clear to me from my experience doing this is that you cannot keep a community alive without that heavy transport, the ferry system coming through. And if we shut them down for the wintertime, we are literally, in a way, stranding them. And so my question becomes to you is, in this study that you're proposing to do, that rural airport evaluation, if some of the airports of these communities is not involved in that and they cannot sustain the kind of operation to keep folks supplied, that's a big deal because you're potentially stranding them without support. So some sort of a blended approach or compromise that allows them to come in, trust me on this one, if you shut down the ferry operations, you are potentially, I hate to say it, but you're potentially strangling those communities because they may not make it through the winter without that if the airports can't support them. And my guess is they can't. I don't think that infrastructure is there. So my question hinges back to saying all that in context, is that we had better make sure in this study that they're checking those airports and looking at what's available to support those communities, because without the ferries, I don't think they'll physically make it. So there's a lot involved in that question, but those two things really concern me of not having that airport study done, if those airports are not included, and what would happen without some sort of heavy service to provide the supplies.
Yeah, thank you for that. Hadn't really thought about, and we have never really discussed it at this table in any detail. If we had a severe issue in Alaska and we had to basically get food supplies and medical supplies into the metropolitan areas, and unfortunately some of us for thousands of years ate fish. There's lots of fish around, but kind of enjoying the current standard of living that this generation or previous generation has bestowed upon us. I'd hate to go back to the ancestral ways of eating herring every day. Once in a while is not bad. Senator Michicki, and then we're going to finish up, and I do apologize for not getting to rural airports. I think we'll wait till the commissioner's here, and he can, and his deputies can explain through the budgetary process the rural issue of rural airports, because there is some concern amongst several of us at this table on rural airports and the other issues. But Senator Michicki.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been pretty quiet the last couple of days. I feel like we're on hold. I want to support dramatic reductions in this budget, but I feel like in the effort to eliminate the cost of parachutes, we didn't evaluate other methods of getting to the ground before we left the plane without one. And I there's so much more information I need in supporting some of the reductions. I feel a little bit hogtied on understanding how we get from here to there with these reductions without a plan, and I don't hear one.
Okay, well, tomorrow we're going to start with fish and game and then natural resources and Department of Conservation. We'll go as far as we can down the list, but on Friday we are still going to have the health and human services here at the table because of the magnitude. We will, and I will work with you, Senator Michicki, to help you support a slight tweak of the budget so we can ensure that the Marine Highway has some skeletal operations through the winter. So if we're going to sell it, at least we have something to sell. And hopefully that will be the case. We'll still have, you know, a cash box that matching it dollar for dollar or some other core service into the system. So I'll work with you, Senator Michicki, to help you with that problem and get you over the finish line, I hope, with the budget. But I'd like to thank OMB for coming today. These are tough discussions and tough questions, but they got to be answered. We got to make a decision. We can't make it in a vacuum. And we have our economics at stake in coastal Alaska and around the state. And I am concerned of the collateral damage of the shipyard when we deal with the Marine Highway, and I hope and I'm sure the governor is equally concerned, because we want to develop and expand our job base, not shrink it. And we don't have a lot of choices, plus we have sunk costs of and we'll get to numbers. My guess is somewhere around $100 million in that shipyard. With that, we'll see everybody tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We are adjourned.